From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. Joining me on the show this week are Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington bureau chief of Al Jazeera Satellite TV, and Tim Mack, congressional correspondent for The Washington Examiner. And here are the issues. President Barack Obama traveled to Europe and reassured allies, telling them that Russia's actions in Ukraine were a challenge to the modern international order. In Ukraine, Russian control of the annexed Crimean Peninsula tightened, while tensions and instability grew elsewhere in Ukraine. In Egypt, the country's military strongman, Field Marshal Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, announced that he's going to run for president. Meanwhile, in a dramatic move, a provincial judge condemned more than 500 people to death for the murder of a single policeman. In Turkey, the Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, banned Twitter and YouTube after illicit recordings of high officials started circulating on the internet. Those are the issues in the news. So let's begin, as we've done so many weeks recently, with what's happening in Ukraine and Europe. We've had a lot of people saying President Obama, as leader of the West, needed to reassure and to rally his allies in Europe. He traveled to Europe. He did a summit with NATO leaders. He spoke to EU leaders. Tim Mack, did he do what he needed to do? You know, is the alliance stronger this week than before President Obama traveled to Europe?
I suppose it's stronger this week than the week before, but there's certainly a lot of eeriness hanging over the entire alliance. This idea that he needs to go and reassure allies that if you were to be invaded by Russia, we would have your back, is not a good signal in the first place. There's not very much confidence in America's leadership in the world.
And let's remind people, there are various ways in which America is allied to European countries, but the most important one, NATO, going back to the Cold War, you have an actual article in a legal treaty, Article 5, that an attack on one member is an attack on all. So effectively, if Putin were to roll his tanks into, say, the Baltic countries next door, that would be treated as an attack on America. And America would be there. Do you think that President Obama signaled, are there things that they're doing with either things he's said or military forces moving around the region that show that America still takes that seriously? Does that promise still mean something?
Well, of course, Ukraine is not a member of NATO. It's not a member of the EU. And the president has sought to reassure his allies in Europe that if this were to happen to them, if there were to be threats from Russia, they would take immediate action. But it's not clear today, any more than it was several weeks ago, that the president means business when it comes to Russia, just because he went and he made these statements.
Abdurrahim, I mean, we assume that Crimea is lost now. That's not coming back. We assume that perhaps if Vladimir Putin wants to roll into chunks of Ukraine, frankly, we're not going to fight him for them. And President Obama said we are not going to fight him with American force. That said, did you get the feeling this week that allies were being rallied in some new way, or we're still sort of slightly unclear as to what President Obama thinks about this alliance?
You know, I think it's becoming very hard to read people's real reactions to President Obama, both here in the United States and certainly abroad. Whether you're talking about the Europeans, whether you're talking about the Gulf Arabs, whether you're talking about other parts of the world, I think the issue of the red line that he'd drawn for the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, and he didn't live up to the threat that if Bashar al-Assad went beyond that red line and used chemical weapons against his people, and for the president to come out and say, yes, he did use chemical weapons and not live up to the military threat that he'd sent Bashar, I think it's making people in Europe, it's making people in other parts of the world really consider whatever means President Obama uses to reach out to them and reassure them that if they come, in this particular case, under threat from Russia, the United States would be there to cover their back. But I think he's walking a very tight rope now. He's spent the first 6 years of his administration saying, I want to make sure that the U.S. doesn't get involved in another war, get out of Iraq, get out of Afghanistan. And then he finds himself rather like the Godfather when he says, played by Al Pacino, he says, every time I want to get out, they pull me back in. He doesn't want to get involved, and yet time after time, crisis after crisis, pushes him in the direction that he doesn't want to go.
Look at the Asia pivot. We were going to have a rebalancing of naval forces to Asia, and now you've got Europeans pleading Tim Mak for American, you know, they want American troops on the ground. Certainly in Poland, would love to have American troops there permanently. You have the Baltic republics, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. They look small, but they're tremendously important. They used to be part of the Soviet Union, although they always felt that they were independent countries under sort of occupation. They're right on the border with Russia. They would love to have serious American military assets right up against that border. And there's a whole discussion as to whether Russia would tolerate that, whether that breaks some of the agreements that were reached between America and Russia when the Soviet Union broke up. Do you think that looking at it from your Washington perspective, is Congress, is the Pentagon, are they ready to sort of put military assets, boots on the ground in these NATO members next to Russia, even if that provokes Vladimir Putin? Is that where we are, or is there no appetite for that?
It's not quite imminent, and the appetite is not great. What we do have appetite for is criticism from the right on the president's foreign policy over the last 6 years, particularly this attempt to reset relations with Russia, to make missile deals with them, to withdraw missile defense projects in Eastern Europe. From a Republican perspective, and even from some of the more hawkish Democrats, so many of the initiatives, the broader initiatives that the president has tried to push on foreign policy, you mentioned the Asia pivot, or the reset on Russia, or its intentions in Iraq, have just not been very successful.
And are we getting into domestic Washington politics? I mean, we've seen people criticizing Hillary Clinton, who, as Secretary of State in the first term of Barack Obama's time, was involved in reaching out. Essentially, you know, this famous reset with Russia was basically an attempt to engage President Medvedev, who was then president. People are now saying that she's somehow to blame for what's happening in Ukraine. Do you think that this is in danger, Abdurrahim, of getting sort of dragged into the usual Washington politics?
Well, obviously, Hillary Clinton is blamed for a lot of things. She's blamed for Russia, as you pointed out. She's blamed for what happened in Libya. But look, I think I get a sense that, first of all, with regard to President Obama's visit to Europe, if he was trying to solidify the alliance with the Europeans, he may have succeeded to a certain extent. But we heard that note of discord, him minimizing the power of Russia, the German Chancellor Merkel saying, no, Russia is actually an important regional power. I don't know what that means in terms of him actually invoking Article 5, but it's becoming quite apparent that Vladimir Putin has got Crimea under the belt. I don't think President Obama or the West can do anything about that now. The issue remains, how far are they going to go to make sure that Putin doesn't have designs beyond Crimea in the neighborhood, particularly in Ukraine?
So, Tim, Abdurrahim makes an excellent point that, you know, Crimea is gone, but Ukraine is still an absolutely live crisis. And you have this large country right on the border with lots of EU members. It has a very, very fragile interim government run by, a mixture of technocrats and pretty junior politicians. You have a very corrupt economy swirling around, and you have these tremendous divisions between broadly an East which, you know, has traditionally looked more towards Russia, and a West which has traditionally looked more towards countries like Poland. Or it's more complicated, but that's more or less the division. And we have tremendous numbers of Russian troops massing right on the border of Ukraine. And we've seen that before. We've seen that in the past has led to an incursion. Do you think that Washington is focused on that and is ready to kind of leap into action with much, much tougher sanctions? Or how focused are people on stopping Putin getting into Ukraine? Or do you think we're sort of slightly resigned to, if he does it, he's going to do it?
I think there's a deep sense of resignation here. I mean, there is an effort in Congress to pass $1 billion worth of loan guarantees for the Ukraine. And that couldn't come at a better time for Ukraine, which has billions of dollars in bonds maturing that it needs to pay out. But in terms of military action, in terms of actually doing something that could stop a Russian incursion into Ukraine, which appears, according to U.S. Intelligence estimates, more and more likely by the hour, there really is no appetite to do anything more than condemn it. And it does seem like an incursion is on the menu. Crimea isn't connected to Russia by any sort of bridge. There's no transportation other than by boat or by plane into Crimea, and Russia has an incentive to create some sort of land corridor to this new territory it claims it has.
And is there a slight sort of disconnect? Because you have, as you say, Republicans attacking President Obama and saying that his lack of strength and his weakness has encouraged President Putin, but they don't actually support him actually doing anything.
I think there is a political reality, which is people are so tired of war. People are so tired of military action. So many people have died over the last decade in Iraq and Afghanistan that for a politician to say, yes, we want boots on the ground, would be almost certain political defeat. It's a funny thing. I mean, Senator Harry Reid, who's the majority leader in the Senate, he said on Monday, earlier this week, if we need to take action, we're going to keep all the senators in Washington, D.C. over the weekend. We're going to have a weekend session. We're going to have emergency legislation. We're going to take care of this issue. And of course, on Thursday afternoon, all the senators left town and nothing happened.
And we can assume constituents, voters are not inundating congressional offices saying, you know, do something about President Putin, do something about Ukraine.
This is not a frequent question that you hear at congressional town halls. Last week, actually, was a congressional recess, and senators and members of Congress all went home. What they're hearing about at home is Obamacare and jobs. They're hearing about, how can I get health insurance? Why is my health insurance policy changing? And why is my friend only able to find part-time work?
Abdurrahim, there was a fascinating moment in President Obama's kind of the main speech that he gave in Europe, where he gave in Brussels, where he was really being, in political terms, pretty fierce about sort of effectively saying that Russia's president, Vladimir Putin, has gone into a kind of dead end of history, that he is, you know, and he is on the wrong side of all of these historical forces that have been sweeping the world. I was slightly surprised that he mentioned the Arab Spring in that list of kind of historical forces, unstoppable forces of freedom and sort of youth and energy. It's been a while since we heard the American president saying such positive things about the Arab Spring. I mean, looking at the whole picture and looking at it slightly from the Arab world, were you surprised by that, to see this, to going back to the idea of, you know, hooray for revolution, despots, watch out? What did you make of that?
I think he is reflecting a strain of thought now in the Arab world that, despite all the terrible tragedies of the so-called Arab Spring in places like Libya, Syria, currently in Egypt also, eventually, according to this strain of thought, these tragedies will play themselves out and people will learn the lesson that freedom doesn't come cheap. And I think he's plugging into that, having originally supported the so-called Arab Spring 3 years ago. He's obviously saying, yes, we're going through ups and downs with this thing called the Arab Spring. When it comes to the nitty-gritty of making policy, I mean, I know we're going to talk about Egypt later on, but if you look at what he said in Europe in the context of what's happening in Egypt, even after Sisi announced his candidacy for the presidency in Egypt, the United States is saying, we do not support either Sisi or anybody else. We have no dog in the race, which is not
true. That's exactly, and we're going to, after the break, I want to come right back onto that on Egypt, because what fascinated me, what I would love to sort of hear more about, is that speech was kind of the speech we've heard from so many American presidents, where it's all rather sort of morally simple, where protesters in the street, young people crying for more freedom, that's fantastic, we encourage that, that looks great to America, and America will be on the side of those kind of forces. And so we saw that list, the Arab Spring, the people in the streets of Kiev. But it hasn't been that simple for quite a while. We've had a president saying, actually, we don't take a view, we're not going to get involved. So we'll come back to that just after the break. We'll have more in just a minute. And first, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, David Rennie of The Economist, and joining me today are Tim Mack of The Washington Examiner and Abdurrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera. This is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Now, just, Tim, I'm very keen to come to you in a second, but because, Abdurrahim, you have such a sort of good overview of what's happening in the Arab world, and because you've had such dramatic events in Egypt over the last few days, which touch very much on that whole idea of the new world order, this clash of ideas President Obama was talking about, it's been a stunning week in Egypt, haven't we? We've had the announcement of who we assume will be the next president and some very dramatic crackdowns in provincial courts. What's been going on this week in Egypt?
Well, as you pointed out, Abdel Fattah Sisi, Field Marshal Abdel Fattah Sisi, who was until 2 days ago the defense minister, is now resigned from the military, whatever that means in the context of Egypt. Obviously, there's seems to be an umbilical cord. Even if somebody resigns from it, they're still part of it. He's going to run for the presidency with a high degree of popularity among Egyptians, supposedly. But the street that has opposed him, that has opposed the coup since it happened some 8 months ago, continues to be restive. We continue to see demonstrations. And these demonstrations are not constrained just to the Muslim Brotherhood or sympathizers with the Muslim Brotherhood. They're actually now touching on other segments of the political spectrum, given the repression that has happened in Egypt over the last few months. Now, if you look at it from the point of view of President Obama, and I'll come to the other part of the question about the mass trials, but if you look at it from the position of the U.S. administration, they are still not sure if the chips are down in Egypt, still not sure exactly which way it's all going to go, how much leeway Sisi will have, even if he becomes Egypt's next president. So it's a fluid situation. Comes to very quickly to the issue of the mass trials.
Well, let's touch on that later, just in a second.
Sure.
I'm very keen to ask Tim Mack, because Tim, you covered Pentagon matters for several years. You're now watching what's happening in Congress. You know, we have on the one hand what you could imagine would be very provocative to Democratic politicians in Washington. You have a military strongman who effectively mounted a coup against an elected government, admittedly a government that had lost popular support, and he is now running for president. And we assume this will not be a cliffhanger election. He will be the next president, and there's lots of signs of repression. What is the mood in Congress? Are people ready to condemn this, to get upset, or are they slightly relieved that this sort of hard man is taking office and clamping down on Islamist forces? What is the reaction in Congress?
I mean, I think it's a mixture of those emotions. It's not quite that simple. It's not pure relief. It's not condemnation. It is we're just going to take a very real politic way of looking at this and see how it goes. I mean, the real issue for Congress when it comes to Egypt is whether or not we can resume military aid, whether or not Egypt creates a government that can be responsible enough for Democrats and Republicans to agree on a package to start sending them tanks and jets again, whether billions of dollars can be restored, and whether American influence through that aid can be restored.
And to what extent do members of Congress see Egypt through the prism of relations with Israel and the wider Middle East?
Almost all of them. I mean, and particularly in the Republican-dominated House of Representatives, the vast majority of members of Congress do see Middle Eastern foreign affairs through the prism of whether or not it's going to help Israel's position in the region.
And so for the moment, they're waiting to see what looks like the least frightening leader to emerge in Egypt.
There are no, I think from that perspective, there are no particularly good options. So they're waiting to see how it plays out.
Abdurrahim, let's turn to this extraordinary, from the outside, extraordinary sentence passed by a provincial judge of more than 500 people sentenced to death for the murder of a single policeman. I think mostly all members of the Muslim Brotherhood. Explain to us what happens next. How political was this? Are they going to be sentenced to death and executed, or is this politics playing its way out through the courts?
Well, the decision of the court is obviously appealable. Ever since the coup, and even before the coup, in fact, ever since Mubarak was toppled,
the coup that threw Muslim Brotherhood out of office,
but even since the toppling of Mubarak 3 years ago, there's been this whole debate about the judiciary in Egypt, how independent it is. Many of the judges had actually been appointed by Mubarak at that time before he stepped down. So there are a lot of questions about this decision to sentence people in mass, particularly if they're Muslim Brotherhood or sympathizers of the Muslim Brotherhood, to what extent it is a fair decision, to what extent it is a politicized decision. My sense is, ultimately, this could play to the favor of Abdel Fattah Sisi. If he becomes president and he looks at it, the appeal process is quite lengthy. It's going to be long enough for him to know whether he's going to be president or not. But if he is president and he looks at it and he says, I'm going to pardon these people, or I'm going to pardon a lot of these people as a sign of goodwill or because mistakes were made, you can only imagine what boost it would actually give him in the initial stages of his presidency.
That's fascinating. Sort of imperial sort of pardons.
Imperial pardons.
And so that we will not see 529 people actually executed for
Probably not, unless some extreme circumstance that we had not foreseen crops up between now and when he takes that decision, if he takes it. But that's my sense. Incidentally, hundreds of others have been referred to the Prosecutor General, mostly from the Muslim Brotherhood and their sympathizers over the last 2 days as well.
Tim, tell me about Washington's views of the Muslim Brotherhood. You have this group which came to power briefly in Egypt, which had been the underground Islamist movement for so many years under the dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak. It seems to me that quite a lot of politicians in Washington were pretty alarmed when the Muslim Brotherhood took power, because there's just a lot of suspicion of anything with the label sort of Islamic or Islamist attached to it as a political movement. Is that right? I mean, do you see people expressing outrage at this death sentence passed on more than 500 members of the Muslim Brotherhood, or are people really not?
There's absolute silence here in Washington. There's always been a lot of talk when it comes to promoting democracy around the world, but there's not a lot of talk when those democracies happen to elect people we're not fans of. And here in Congress, there's very little interest in condemning the convictions or executions, supposed executions of Muslim Brotherhood members.
Do you think, in fact, I mean, to finish the thought, really, that the state of American public opinion after 13 years of war in the Muslim world is really an awful lot of Americans, and this feeds into their elected politicians, they sort of decided that the Muslim world is somehow beyond fixing and that America has no business trying to fix it. And it may be a depressing way of looking at the world, but that's quite a powerful force in American public opinion.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and that is a powerful current that's running through public opinion right now. And people, you know, I was out in Arizona earlier this week covering a few congressional
races.
Very conservative state in the Southwest, but that is increasingly independent in terms of its voter registration. People don't want to think about foreign affairs. People don't want to think about the world around them outside the United States' borders. What they do want to think about is whether they have a job, whether their town is suffering or not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, from the real world of security to the virtual world, we have this extraordinary sort of fuss in Turkey this week. We've seen these illicit recordings of high officials discussing embarrassing things, either corruption or national security matters, and an extraordinary reaction from the democratic elected government of Turkey, which first banned Twitter, which proves to be harder than it looks because people can get around it, and now banned YouTube. So, Abdurrahim, what is going on in Turkey, this democratic country on the borders of Europe?
Well, I think what's going on is a unique intersection of the real world, as you mentioned it, and the virtual world, as you mentioned it. Real world, because the trials and tribulations of Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan actually hark back to the so-called Arab Spring. He took some very strong positions on these authoritarian regimes in Libya, in Egypt, in Syria. And that's now coming back to haunt him. Not many of the positions that he'd taken on the Arab Spring have been successful. And now he has to deal with his own problems hailing back from those positions, which were not very popular among the Turkish opposition. That real-world problem is now compounded by this virtual-world problem for him to actually take the extraordinary decision in a country which the Americans had for a long time heralded as a model for Islamic democracy, and take that decision against Twitter and Facebook is absolutely extraordinary.
And leaving aside the sort of the symbolism of that, this kind of essentially kind of old men trying to shut down how young people talk to each other, which is never very successful, is there a sense that actually as you say, he is caught between, you know, the famous Turkish deep state, the sort of the mysterious military intelligence security world, which is never completely under the control of the government, the kind of people who can do the spying. Someone is spying effectively enough to release these recordings of ministers talking about national security in their own offices, and they're suddenly emerging on the internet. And so he's caught between young people who are outraged at their loss of Twitter and this kind of deep, invisible state that is putting these very damaging recordings on the internet. Is that? Do you think, where he's...
Yes. I mean, I think that the popular dissatisfaction with the policies or the outcome of his policies in places such as Egypt, where he supported the Muslim Brotherhood, and now the failure of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt because of the coup has come back to roost in Turkey, given the fact that he also hails from an Islamist party in Turkey. So there's that current which is sweeping through all those different countries. Twitter and Facebook, remember, were famously used by the youth in the so-called Arab Spring in Egypt, in Syria, and elsewhere. Mm. Governments have since learned how to use those same methods to their advantage, and forces opposing Erdogan in Turkey are now using those same methods on him at this intersection that I talked about, where the real world intercuts with the virtual world.
And Tim, how's this gone down in America? I mean, people talk about the optics of things in American politics, how they look. Banning Twitter, banning YouTube, these are bad optics in American politics, is that right?
Quite obviously, I think so. I mean, one of the really interesting images to come out of the banning of Twitter is how ridiculous it is. This image of graffiti on a building showing people who are walking by on the street how to bypass government servers. In Arizona, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton had a conference in which Jimmy Wales, the co-founder of Wikipedia, called the denial of access to the internet a human rights abuse. I mean, this is terrible optic.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, that's all the time we have. And joining us today were Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Satellite TV, and Tim Mack, Congressional Correspondent for the Washington Examiner. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm David Rennie of The Economist. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.